So I'd like to talk now a bit about equanimity itself. We talked this morning a little bit about that the spiritual journey can replace the outer armor of defensiveness against the difficulties of the world with an inner invisible armor, invisible protection, and that we can't afford to go through life busy with the outer protection, because the outer protection, if we are busy sustaining it, working at it, defending ourselves, making sure we live right, making sure we're in the Buddha's castle, the comfort zone, and we spend all our life defending this comfort zone. I don't want illness, I don't want discomfort, I don't want this, I'm protecting myself here, protecting myself there. So suddenly, from birth to death, we're busy with that, our life is over. And we've been totally invested in protection and making sure that we're comfortable. And we just can't afford that. It's not that we shouldn't do it. I'm thoroughly enjoying my cup of tea. It's not that we have to be absolute suffering ascetics, and the Buddha taught the teaching of the middle way. But we just can't afford to keep investing in the outer protection, because that's where our energy will go, and that's where what we will become. We will be busy with defending ourselves. So the inner protection is different, completely different. And then it allows us to be open, to be insightful, to be sensitive, to be non-anesthetic, to be vulnerable, to allow ourselves to be vulnerable and to be all right. And that's the key of equanimity, to allow ourselves to be vulnerable and it's all right. In fact, it's necessary, because that's the truth, that we are vulnerable. We are fragile human beings dumped into this body. We don't know why. And we're just here sort of on the knife edge. And so instead of trying to put this outer protection and hold the world out there and then believing, like in the poem I read this morning, that the world is against us, we build inner protection, which is allowing vulnerability and being all right in that vulnerable place. It's very human. It's very alive. It's very interesting. It's not so bad. There's a well-known English phrase that says, when the pot boils over, don't leave the kitchen. When the pot boils over, don't leave the kitchen. In other words, be right in the eye of the storm, not running away from the storm. Be in the middle, in the eye of the storm. It's all right. It's a place you can be. Our problem is the fear of it, not the middle of it. And so to be in the midst of things is the place of equanimity. It's the inner protection of equanimity. And this protection takes the form of non-attachment. And we know the second noble truth of the Buddha is attachment. Equanimity is where non-attachment means that we don't have a very strong sense of me that needs to defend itself. The Buddha is pictured with long ears. You know why? It's because he is so empty that he can hear the cry and the call and the pain of the whole world, of all the beings in the world, and is not destroyed because of his inherent emptiness. And it's even a little bit like we discussed this morning, the glass. Allowing all, not being, the glass is not a barrier, a wall, it's a glass. It receives, we do receive, we need to be open and receive our pain and the world pain and the others with a compassionate open heart and not shut it out. But if we're not attached, then it doesn't stick. It doesn't create chaos and difficulty, and it doesn't destroy us. So we can receive pain, and we can allow it, our own or others, allow the vulnerability, and allow it to pass through us. Not shut it out. Be there with it, be open to it, but it doesn't stick inside and destroy us. And one of the images of that is the Zen story of the empty boat. And maybe some of you know the story. Do you all know the story? Oh, good. So I can tell it. A boatman was on one bank of the river, and a passenger came and said, "I want to go to the other side of the river." So the boatman said, "Okay, I'll take you across the other side." In the middle of the stream, another boat came down the river with another boatman inside and a passenger, and he bumped into this boat. And the boatman started to shout, "You stupid, why did you do that? You didn't look where you're going, you bumped into me." It happens here in the freeways, I guess. What's the matter with you? Look where you're going, and shouting. Anyway, then they went on, and another boat came down the river with no one inside it and hit this boat. And the boatman didn't say anything. So the passenger said, "Well, you shouted at the first boat. Why didn't you shout at the second boat? It did the same damage." And the boatman said, "Well, there's nobody to shout at." So if we are the empty boat, there is nobody to shout at. There is nobody here to suffer. We feel the pain. We can be vulnerable, but inside there's nobody there. There's no sufferer to accumulate the pain and to accumulate the wounds and to build what is sometimes called a pain body, a body of pain which we carry with us all our life. So equanimity, like all the paramis, actually like every one of the paramis or paramitas that we discussed this morning, they are paramis because fundamentally they're qualities of the empty being. They're qualities of, and let's come down a little bit from emptiness, okay, because it sounds very high. But let's say not that ultimate emptiness, but just being less full of ourselves, less protective of ourselves, less busy with ourselves, less important self-importance. So to some extent empty, and not this ultimate absolute anatta that is in the realm of the gods, okay, and Buddhas. But yes, each one of us feeling more spacious, more open, allowing vulnerability, and having the protection of non-attachment inside. Equanimity is one of the three calming factors. There's calmness, and there's concentration, and equanimity. And these are the three calming paramis. They're also factors of awakening. They actually appear again and again in different forms in the Dharma, in different lists. The Buddha loved lists, and there's a number of lists, and equanimity is in nearly every list. And it it has in it a quality of steadiness, as I've said at least 500 times now, of balance. Equanimity comes from the word equal. It's more like a active being equal with things, There is a famous description of it in a famous story of a general that arrived in a monastery in China, and he knocked on the door and no one answered. And eventually, after some time, a monk appeared at the door, opened the door slowly, and the general said, "Do you know who I am?" Expecting the monk to bow down. The monk said, "No idea." And the general was a bit cross and said, "I can split your body with my sword in the blink of an eye." Expecting the monk to really be scared, and the monk looked at him in the face and said, "Do you know who I am?" And the general said, "No. I am somebody that can be split into two pieces in the blink of an eye." That's the image of equanimity. But in truth, equanimity is not about being equal, because life isn't equal. It's a dynamic process of allowing things to be unfair or difficult or easy. It's the same whether life is in the heaven realms, which sometimes equals California maybe, and sometimes not, or the hell realms, that we are equal in all realms. It's not that life has to be equal, but we are equal. I've got a good example of this. I mentioned before, last night in the picnic, and also a little bit this morning, that I've done a lot of work with Palestinians and Israelis. And we tried over years, many years, to do different kinds of peace work, bringing Palestinians and Israelis together. And one of the things we did, and I'll be talking, I think, more about this perhaps in the discussion evening and in the sitting group in
San Jose.
San Jose, yeah. They asked to talk about this. One of the things we did was, over several years, we brought groups of Palestinians and Israelis together, and actually bringing Israelis to the Palestinian territories, which produces instant fear. So talking about fear, we needed all the work to reduce the fear of Israelis going to the Palestinian territories and staying and sleeping in Palestinian homes and feeling that definitely someone's going to slit their throat at the night. But we managed to do this over years and years, and it was risk-free, actually. But one of the things that kept coming up was the asymmetry. And the Palestinians would say, "You don't realize how we suffer 100 times more than you. You keep talking, you Israelis keep talking about the Holocaust that happened 2-3 generations ago, but we are suffering a Holocaust right now, with every single family has one person killed, one person in prison, kids growing up utterly traumatized. We are suffering, every single family, not a single family that hasn't suffered under the military occupation. And so how can you talk about suffering?" And we used to work with this to say, the asymmetry is part of the suffering. There is asymmetry. We cannot make this equal, but allow the asymmetry itself to be arriving because of karma or because of situations which are quite beyond our control. That too, the asymmetry itself, is a form of suffering. Be with it. Allow it. It is not in our hands. Let's just hold the asymmetry as well as part of the suffering of the situation. So it's not about being equal, but it's about us being equal to the situation. The situation itself can never be equal. We'll always feel we have more difficulty than we ought to, or we have not enough benefit than we ought to. In meditation itself, we can practice equanimity in a sense, in the way we were doing before. Equanimity is happening by itself every time we are not busy selecting experiences. Right? You understand what I mean by selecting experiences? Means choosing a good experience, not a difficult one. Saying, well, I won't look at the painful bit of my body, I'll just be with the pleasant. As soon as there's a painful part of my body, I'll put that aside. Or I will look for pleasant thoughts. My difficult thoughts, I won't go there. Or basically dressing up a meditation to have the rose and forgetting that the rose has thorns. Right? It's having the rose and the thorns as they come, equally. Ready for this, ready for that. Ready for the angels, ready for the demons. And that non-selective practice in meditation, which is closer to ourselves, it's our own, in a way, psychological self-treatment or psychological meeting with ourselves, that sense of taking this with that non-selectivity in mindfulness, is right in mindfulness. It's a fundamental quality of mindfulness. And it's one of the great gifts of mindfulness. That's why it's useful in therapy and used in therapy. Taking this and taking that. Taking this and taking that. So, for example, when the mindfulness is used to treat OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, which I'm just a side bracket here of the mindfulness used in the professional sector. So OCD patients are taught that when they see the loop in the mind that says, I've got to clean my sink 100 times, I've got to clean my sink, I've got to clean my sink, I've got to clean my sink, that they just see this as a loop in the mind of no more importance than another thought that says, oh, I'm going to have a cup of coffee. No more importance. One is like this, one is like that. This sense of not prioritizing the one thing over another, the non-selective nature of mindfulness practice, is therapeutic, and it's also equanimity. It helps us to be with what is, whatever it is, and stay steady with it. Something comes up, we are steady. Thoughts come up, uncontrollable thoughts, we're steady. Pain comes up, we're steady. Pleasure comes up, we're steady. It's a wonderful internal weather, beautiful sunny day inside my mind. I'm steady with it. Terrible weather in my mind, storms and lightning, terrible thoughts and hard time. I'm steady with it. Here I am. So this sense, that's the equal. I would like to quote a sutta quote on this. Mahara Hulavoda Sutta. Develop meditation that is like the earth. For then agreeable or disagreeable contacts with the world through the senses will not invade the mind. Just as people throw clean and dirty things, they throw shit and urine and spit and blood on the earth, and the earth is not horrified or dismayed or disgusted, but just absorbs it all. And the same with water, fire and air, the other elements, just as people throw clean and dirty things into the water, etc., into the fire, into the air. The water, the fire, the air is not horrified or dismayed or disgusted and just absorbs it all. And the same with our meditation. Part what helps us with equanimity too is having, and this is where teachings are important, having a big view, having almost like a view of karma. I know karma is a big word, means different things to different people, but shall we say it's being in the flow of conditions and conditionality, that conditions happen, they just happen, and there is a flow of conditions all the time that affects us. And if we watch this flow of conditions, and to some extent we dissolve them, we also take part, purify, take part in it. It's not, we're not just passive, we are taking part in the flow of conditions. We begin to get a more relational view of life. Life as relation, life as relationship, life as flow. And this too helps us, it gives us equanimity, it gives us the equanimity, it helps us with equanimity. Life is relational, our experience is relationship. We are less, again, a kind of a unit called a self that is having to cope with the world. Instead, flow, relationship, relational understanding. Our meditation becomes relational, means we see things coming up and going, and we're in relationship to our thoughts, the outside, the inside. We're always in relationship to. And this understanding is slowly, it's one of these shifts in understanding that grows with us as we move on the spiritual life. And it makes for ease. It makes for ease. We become at ease because we're in flow of relationship. We're not, again, protecting and struggling against. We're not in friction. Everything is flowing. Things happen. I do. It is done to me, I do to others. I talk, I listen. I'm sitting, all the world is talking. All the voices in my head come because of all the voices that have come in there all my life. They're just, mind is just repeating everything it's picked up. Like a mind is like a radar or a radio receiver. Just, so we're in relationship all the time. And this, it's again an impersonal, something freeing us. We're in the stream. It's less personal. And this helps our equanimity. There is one confusion that is very common, that equanimity is often confused with indifference. And it's a common mistake. People say, oh, equanimity, you Buddhists, you must have heard this before, you Buddhists are all very calm and indifferent or detached. You're detached. It's easy to be, have a good life, you just be detached. Well, actually the reverse is the truth. I think anyone who practices and watches their own mind is not detached. You're right in there. You get your hands dirty, shall we say. You're right in the middle of things. You're not detached at all. You are actually getting yourself inside. The detachment is the what we talked about before, the protection that says, I want to keep the world out there and close the door, lock the door, and be in the Buddha's castle, and be in the Buddha's palace, in my comfort zone. Turn on the TV, shut the door, and that's detached. The spiritual life is exactly the opposite. It is involved, engaged in the relational world. So indifference or detachment has in it fear. Detachment is about fear, it's withdrawal. And equanimity is not about withdrawal. It's about being alive and balanced and steady in the middle, in the eye of the storm. The first quote I mentioned is, when the pot boils over, don't leave the kitchen. Right, it's that. Don't leave the kitchen. The pot's boiling over, don't leave the kitchen. That's not indifferent. That's not detachment. There's I don't know if any of you read T.S. Eliot, but he has in the Four Quartets, there's a very beautiful quote, which I don't remember it exactly, but he says, the difference between equanimity and detachment, although they grow in the same hedgerow, he called it, they are as different from each other as life and death. Although they grow, they seem to grow in the same place, the same hedge, but indifference, well, detachment and equanimity are, he used another word for equanimity, which I can't remember what it is, but it's a similar word. They're actually as different as life and death. So, equanimity is actually the last of the paramis. The first of the paramis is generosity, which we're going to talk about in one of these evenings, maybe on Tuesday. And equanimity is the last one. Although I decided that I wanted to make it the first here in our series, because it's such a potent, quality, and also it's so important to understand fear and fearlessness, and it goes together. But it's also the last one, and it is traditionally, it's actually what happens in very advanced practice. That you may have, if you read Shaila's book on deep concentration practices, on the jhanas, the equanimity is in a way the final experience. Everything boils down to equanimity. There is some dynamic balance that happens that takes the place of all other kinds of experiences in meditation. For example, she discusses, and it's classical in the jhanas, that the first of the jhana factors is a real lift up, is joy, a kind of ecstatic, energetic joy, and it's born of concentration. And then the next jhana, or the next of the jhana factors, this joy becomes softer and turns into sort of happiness, and then it turns into contentment, and then it turns into equanimity. So gradually all the experiences become softer and softer, and they sort of boil down in the end to this soft, dynamic balance in life, flowing with life. And some of the other kind of meditation experiences feel crude in relation to equanimity. And the Buddha said, in terms of advanced practitioners, he said at the end of the line, the journey, there remains only equanimity, purified, bright, soft and radiant. Just like a skilled goldsmith would take some gold and prepare a furnace and heat it and put in the gold, and from time to time it would burn, and from time to time he would blow on it, and from time to time he would sprinkle water on it, and from time to time he would just look at it. And the gold will be well refined, will be rid of impurity, will be soft, will be shining. And you can make necklaces, or you can make anything out of it. And so remains just equanimity. It's a beautiful vision. I think you can get that vision of our life experience being like that gold, refined and soft and flexible. So to finish, I also want to mention that equanimity is one of the Brahma Viharas. And the Brahma Viharas are the four great celestial heart qualities of metta, loving kindness, karuna or compassion, mudita or joy, empathic joy, and upekkha, which is equanimity. And upekkha is giving that balance For example, when we have heart relationship to the to another or to the world, or we compassion, we need something underneath to make it balanced. Otherwise, it can get a bit overbalanced. Our heart can take over. So equanimity offers a balance there, and it itself is a heart quality as well. It's a heartful relational quality. It's in the world, in the life. It's not just a mental quality of mind or intellect that is kind of theoretically looking at life and finding balance, like a kind of a distant observer or intellectual that is writing wonderful books, but sort of like the university where I studied in Oxford in England, there's plenty of those that sit inside their ivory castle, their closed room, and write wonderful books about all sorts of things, and then have tea. And they're rather cut off and in the ivory tower. But it is a relational, equanimity is relational. It's about being in relationship to and finding the balance on the waves. And so it's one of the Brahmaviharas. Now, the Brahmaviharas are practiced sometimes using phrases. The Buddha taught the Brahmaviharas is slightly differently as energetic quality. And he taught metta, loving kindness, as a vibration. And the same with equanimity, as a kind of energy. But after the Buddha, the Brahmaviharas were taught using phrases and repeating phrases to yourself. Like, may all beings be happy is a metta phrase. So most of you have met these phrases before, but there are equanimity phrases. And I put them up on the board there. And we're going to practice after this equanimity phrases. That's just something that gives us this quality of equanimity in a direct meditation on equanimity itself. I'll just say what they are. May I accept things as they are, is one phrase. May I be undisturbed by the coming and going of events. And the third, I am the owner or the heir of my karma. I'm the heir, meaning like inheritor. I inherit my karma. I receive my karma, or I am the receiver of my karma. But I only wrote up two phrases there. May I accept things as they are, and I'll go through these again before the meditation, and not the karma one, because it just can get confusing, because karma can be a confusing concept. So I leave it aside. We anyway don't need any special phrase. It's just the feeling behind the phrase. But those are the two classic phrases that we can use very easily and simply. And I wrote them up on the board, and we will do them as practice soon. Okay, so thank you very much. I'll just take one moment of silence before we have questions. I'm very happy to have questions now. But let's have a moment of silence just to absorb what we've heard, and then we can have questions and responses.